Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Etablissement, dem kleinen Theater-Podcast für den Herrn, der einen guten Coupon zu schätzen weiß. So, jetzt bin ich in New York. Das ist ja Teil meines Thomas Mann Fellowships und habe hier die Gelegenheit, mich ein wenig in der Theaterszene, Bühnenszene, Kabarettszene, Dragszene, Comedy-Szene umzugucken, um vielleicht auch mal zu schauen, wie unterschiedlich das ist oder wie das hier funktioniert im Gegensatz zu Deutschland, wo diese Trennung zwischen Unterhaltung und Ernstem ja total streng ist oder streng scheint. Jetzt bin ich eine Woche hier, habe mich am Anfang so ziemlich auf den Broadway konzentriert. Das erste Stück, was ich gesehen habe, war Death Becomes Her. So, und dazu muss ich sagen, ich bin, seit ich jugendlich bin, einfach ein totaler Musical-Fan. Obwohl ich selber ja eher so aus dem experimentellen Musiktheaterbereich komme, habe ich irgendwie so diesen Background oder diese Vorgeschichte. Das heißt, ich liebe das Genre per se schon immer und kenne ziemlich viele Stücke, habe aber nie etwas am Broadway gesehen, war nie in New York und kenne Broadway-Shows eigentlich nur aus London oder wenn sie mal nach Deutschland gekommen sind. Aber ich habe London immer so ein bisschen so als Ersatz für New York genommen, weil ich habe Flugangst und bin da nie hingekommen. Und dachte, naja, London kommt dem so am nächsten. So, nun habe ich an einem Dienstagabend Death Becomes Her mir angeschaut, was so eine der letzten riesigen Neuproduktionen hier am Broadway ist. Und ich muss sagen, ich habe da gesessen wie ein Kind. Es hat mich so erfreut, die ganze Sache. Man verliert das ja manchmal so etwas, wenn man selber im Theater arbeitet, dass man in Deutschland im Theater sitzt und das alles mit so Kollegenaugen anguckt und denkt, wie ist das gemacht? Wie hat man das gemacht? Warum kommt das gut an? Warum kommt das schlecht an? Man guckt das so wahnsinnig analytisch und ich habe da wirklich im Theater gesessen wie ein Kind mit einem breiten Grinsen und ist das Stück auch irgendwie ja so gemacht und fordert irgendwie gerade dazu auf. Das ist halt ein riesiger Romp, ein riesiger Ausstattungsorgie, witzig, nach dem Film mit Meryl Streep und Goldie Hawn. Es war ganz interessant, dass ich da drin saß und dachte, wenn diese Musicals nach Deutschland kommen, importiert werden, selbst wenn sie nach London kommen, das kann irgendwie nicht das abbilden, was hier tatsächlich stattfindet, wenn man die Show so um den Times Square rum in einem dieser riesigen Theater sieht. Also irgendwie fällt das Genre und der Ort schon auf irgendeine ganz seltsame Art so in eins. Also es ist eine bestimmte Art zu spielen, es wird wahnsinnig viel verkauft, es hat einen wahnsinnigen Humor, es ist total detailverliebt, es findet alles auf so einem etwas hysterischen Level statt, das einfach genau dahin passt. Also das Genre macht hier auf einmal so viel mehr Sinn. Es fühlt sich so anders an, als zum Beispiel eine Broadway-Show in London zu sehen, also eine Show, die am Broadway Premiere hatte und dann nach London gebracht wurde. Das, was mir zuerst auffiel, war, dass um das Theater herum eine wahnsinnige Aufregung herrscht. Das heißt, man muss seine Tickets vorzeigen, man muss seine Tasche präsentieren, die Tasche wird durchleuchtet. Es gibt ziemlich viel Sicherheitspersonal draußen vor den Theatern oder Theaterpersonal, das ist irgendwie kaum zu unterscheiden. Man fühlt sich fast so ein bisschen, als ob man irgendwie in einen Tatort reinläuft. Also man wird auch ziemlich so angeherrscht und da durchgehetzt. Man darf nicht stehen bleiben, man soll nicht im Weg stehen. Also das findet alles sehr, sehr schnell und direkt und manchmal auch so ein bisschen schroff statt. Also häufig auch sehr amerikanisch freundlich, aber häufig auch sehr, direkt. Und wenn man so ein bisschen von der Großstadt, man kommt da aus der U-Bahn, man kennt sich nicht gut aus, man wankt da so rein und weiß jetzt nicht, wie funktioniert das hier, kann man da auch manchmal so ein bisschen irgendwie blöd rumstehen und wird dann aber sehr schnell sozusagen so in dieses System draußen vor der Tür hier sich hinstellen, dann da rein, dann hier die Tasche auf, dann da das Ticket und so weiter so reingesaugt. Was, glaube ich, für Leute, die neu im Theater sind, vielleicht auch total hilfreich ist. Also ich dachte so ein bisschen, das geht hier aber zackig zur Sache. Andererseits denke ich, hat der Broadway natürlich viel Publikum, die einfach vielleicht noch nie im Theater waren, die nicht so genau wissen, wie verhält man sich, wo geht's lang, wo geht's rein, wo geht's weiter. Für die ist das vielleicht total hilfreich, dass man quasi so richtig geführt wird. Und dann, das war im Land Fontaine Theater, das ist ein ziemlich großes Theater, fand ich auffällig, dass es überhaupt keine Foyers gibt. Also es ist mehr oder weniger so, man kommt von draußen rein, es gibt vielleicht irgendwie noch so einen ganz schmalen Vorraum und dann steht man aber eigentlich schon im Saal. Das heißt, das ganze Theater besteht aus Sitzen, was ja Sinn macht, weil es ist kommerzielles Theater, das heißt, man will verkaufen und man verschwendet da keinen Platz für, wir stehen jetzt rum, trinken noch einen Sekt. Also es wird auch in der Pause ordentlich verkauft und auch Drinks verkauft, aber das findet alles auf sehr gedrängter Fläche statt. Und sobald man dann reinkommt in das Theater selbst oder in den Theaterraum selber, finde ich, läuft das auf, gibt so wie so ein Change. Das Sicherheitspersonal ist nicht mehr da, sondern man hat diese Usher, die einen dann fragen, wo man hin muss, die einem zeigen, wo man hingesetzt wird und einem dann diese Playbill in die Hand drücken. Das ist quasi das Programmheft. Das funktioniert hier in New York allerdings so. Das fand ich eigentlich fast ganz schön. Das ist so ein Universalheftchen, das alle Theater verteilen, nur das Cover und die Besetzungsliste darin wird dem Stück angepasst. Das heißt, es gibt dann immer so dieses markenartige Cover dieser Playbill. Also die Musicals versuchen ja wirklich auch immer so eine Stücke, auch die Plays, so eine eindeutig wiedererkennbare Marke irgendwie zu werden. Das heißt, die ist immer vorne drauf. Das heißt, die Dinger sind auch wie so eine Art Sammlungsobjekt. Aber gleichzeitig dadurch, dass dann da Interviews drin sind, auch über andere Stücke, was läuft in den anderen Häusern und so weiter, sind die auch gleichzeitig dann immer so eine Werbung für das, was es sonst noch so gibt. Das heißt, man hat immer so das Gefühl, das Theater befindet sich in so einem Netz von anderen Stücken, die man auch noch sehen kann. Also das ist so ein bisschen so dieses Upsell-Prinzip, was es in Amerika gibt. Das heißt, man kommt und hat schon was gekauft und dann versuchen sie einem noch mehr zu verkaufen. Also wenn man es jetzt mal so platt beschreiben will. Das ganze Auditorium in dem Ding war tatsächlich auch so ein bisschen so der Show schon angepasst. Das heißt, es gibt auch immer so ein bisschen so einen immersiven Aspekt bei der ganzen Sache. Also in dem Fall war das ganze Haus so lila angestrahlt. Ich bilde mir sogar ein, in den Kronleuchtern hatten sie die Glühbirnen so ausgetauscht, sodass das Ganze irgendwie so ein bisschen so zu dieser zauberhaften Atmosphäre irgendwie dieser Geschichte da irgendwie passte, ne? Wo ja diese beiden Frauen quasi ein Jugendelixier von einer Zauberin einnehmen und daran hängt sich dann so eine Komödie irgendwie auf. Das heißt, der ganze Raum war schon so in dieses Licht getaucht, genauso wie am Ende beim Applaus des Stücks dann in den Zuschauerraum sich so eine riesige Fiole absenkte, die dann quasi zum Applaus wie so eine Disco-Kugel sich drehte, die den Zuschauerraum auch nochmal so mit der Bühne verband. Die kriegen ja dieses Jugendelixier von Michelle Williams, die diese Zauberin spielt, also Michelle Williams of Destiny's Child Fame, muss man ja sagen, kriegen sie diese Fiole überreicht und die kommt dann wie so eine Art Disco-Kugel zum Applaus runter. Das heißt, irgendwie hat das alles immer so ein immersives Element. Auch dieses ganze Verkaufen in der Pause werden dann Cocktails verkauft, die benannt sind nach Figuren auf der Bühne. Es gab Fächer mit Zitaten aus dem Stück, ein Fächer mit dem Satz En Guard, Bitch, der irgendwie so eine Punchline in dem Stück ist. Das heißt, das Publikum wird eh auf so eine ganz einerseits kann man natürlich sagen, verkaufsfördernde Weise da so eingebunden, aber es hilft natürlich auch dem ganzen Abend. Und ja, dann rollt irgendwann dieses Stück los und dann geht der Vorhang auf und da steht Michelle Williams als diese Besitzerin dieser Magic Potion und singt eine riesige Eröffnungsnummer und das Publikum steht ab Sekunde 1 mehr oder weniger auf den Stühlen. Natürlich sieht Michelle Williams in einem Glitzerkleid auch fantastisch aus. Sie singt die Noten wie keine andere und ist einfach eine Ikone. Und natürlich stehen die Leute auf den Füßen, aber man kennt das so aus Deutschland eigentlich gar nicht. Also, dass das Publikum quasi von Sekunde 1 an schon überzeugt ist. Also, die Herangehensweise ist eher, ich habe hier quasi für ein Event bezahlt, die Tickets sind ja nicht billig und bin Teil dieser Erfahrung und bin Teil davon, hier das ein Remarkable Evening zu machen. Und das macht natürlich, wenn man dabei sitzt und eher so ein bisschen so dieses deutsche, zurückgelehnte, ich schmauche meine Pfeife und gucke mir im Brecht-Sinne an, was hier passiert. Wenn man das so drauf hat, dann zieht einen das natürlich wahnsinnig mit. Und dann ja, das ganze Genre, die Show, die dann abrollt, ich will das gar nicht so im Einzelnen beschreiben, ich fand nur, dass so diese Spielweise, diese Mixtur von Zutaten, also es ist ja halb Drag, also die Frauencharaktere, die da auftauchen, das sind ja eigentlich kaum Frauen, das sind ja wie so Gay Fantasies über Frauen, also eigentlich wie so Drag Queens, die aber fantastisch spielen. Das Ganze sieht natürlich total naturalistisch ausgestattet aus, gibt wahnsinnige Zaubereffekte, wenn die da die Treppen runterfallen und sich ein Loch in den Bauch schießen und so weiter. Aber letztlich sieht das ja alles sehr realistisch aus. Und die Spielweise kippt dann aber, wenn es in diese Komödienszenen geht, auch schon fast in sowas Sophie Reuss-haftes, Volksbühnenhaftes. Also es wird dann so extrem, aber es ist natürlich immer gegroundet, so dadurch, dass es alles so aussieht, wie es aussieht. Also so ganz normal, so wie man sich das vorstellt. Und dann ist es ja so eine Mischung, Fairground Attraction ist da irgendwie auch noch mit drin, ne? Also diese Rieseneffekte, die aufgefahren werden. Die Musik ist, ja geht, aber es war ein fantastischer Abend. Also man fragt sich vielleicht so ein bisschen, ne? Es ist so eine Geschichte zwischen den beiden Frauen, dieser Zauberin und dem Ehemann, der zwischen diesen beiden Frauen noch so hin und her wechselt. Also es ist eigentlich könnte ein sehr kleines Stück sein, aber dann gibt es natürlich ein riesiges Ensemble und man fragt sich so ein bisschen, warum, was tanzen die da alle die ganze Zeit, wer sind diese Leute? Aber es ist natürlich eine Broadway-Show und da gehört das irgendwie ja wohl auch dazu. Ja, dann endet die Show, der Applaus ist total kurz, also es wird sich einmal verbeugt zur Musik, dann geht der Vorhang auch schon zu. Also man geht so raus und denkt so, ach, man hätte sie gern nochmal gesehen. Ne? Das ist auch so dieser Effekt, man gibt den Leuten nicht ganz das, was sie wollen, sondern leave them wanting more, so quasi. Ja, und dann gehen die Türen zur Seite auf und dann steht man mehr oder weniger auch schon wieder auf der Straße. Also, Show is over, tschüss, raus. Und da fängt dann auch schon wieder diese so ein bisschen so diese Hetze an, die man auch vom Einlass her kennt. Hier lang, hier lang, hier lang. Und genau, es endet dann so ein bisschen unromantisch. Aber ich muss sagen, es hat mich wirklich total begeistert, das ganze Ding. Und es war ein Riesenspaß. Ich bin ziemlich froh, dass das meine erste Broadway-Show war. Nächsten Tag habe ich dann gesehen Gypsy mit Audra McDonald, was per se ein fantastisches Musical ist. Also da ist einfach die Musik und die Performance von Audra McDonald einfach total stark und Gypsy, Jules Stein, Stephen Sondheim, die Lyrics ist einfach so ein Klassiker und ist fast so ein bisschen wie so das amerikanische King Lear des Musical Theaters, kann man sagen. Und Audra McDonald, fantastisch und es gibt in dem Score auch irgendwie keine Nummer, die irgendwie schlecht ist. Also da jagt ein Highlight das nächste. Und dann habe ich noch Sunset Boulevard gesehen. In der Jamie Lloyd-Inszenierung, die ja so total stripped down ist, wo das auch sehr ähnlich funktioniert. Bei Gypsy hießen die Cocktails in der Pause Gotta Get a Gimlet, nach dem Song You Gotta Have a Gimmick. Rose's Turn, das ist die große Nummer von Rose am Ende des zweiten Aktes, wenn sie fast so in den Wahnsinn abdriftet. Das ist ein Cocktail mit Rosé-Wine, Splash of Cranberry und Splash of Soda. Dann Tipsy Gypsy, Tequila, Triple Sec, Lime, Lemon Lime mit Soda und Herbie Burby, Bourbon Ginger Ale, Cranberry Juice. Herbie ist der Love Interest von Rose. Sunset Boulevard gab es auch Cocktails. Ich schaue noch mal. Und zwar gab es da den Leading Lady Lemonade. Mocktail, der war alkoholfrei. Dann der Sunset Boulevardier. Dann The Close-Up. Das ist Gin, Cava with a splash of Pear and Pomegranate. Dann gab es den Frozen Fame und den Tequila Sunset. Tequila, Grenadine, Lime, Orange. Das waren jetzt tatsächlich drei so riesige, klassische, kommerzielle Broadway-Produktionen. Und dann habe ich noch Oh Mary gesehen, was eine etwas andere Geschichte hat. Das ist ein Stück, das Cole Escola, nutzt They Them Pronomen, geschrieben hat, was am Lucille Lortel Theater auf Broadway Premiere hatte und da so ein riesiger Erfolg war, dass es an den Broadway transferiert wurde und da ziemlich erfolgreich läuft. Das Ganze ist quasi wie so eine Fantasy, historische Fantasy. Cole Escola spielt Mary Todd Lincoln, die Ehefrau von Abraham Lincoln, die einerseits Alkoholikerin ist, zweitens ein washed-up Cabaret-Star und ins Cabaret zurückkehren will. Und Abraham will das Ganze verhindern, weil es ihm einerseits, er ist ja verkappter Homosexueller, zu schwul erscheint und auch nicht angemessen für eine Leading Lady. Und Cole Escola spielt Mary Todd Lincoln. Das ist einfach ganz fantastisch. Es ist dann so eine Art, Liebeskomödie vielleicht auch. Also so dieses Ehepaar Abraham engagiert ihr dann einen Schauspiellehrer, um sie von ihrem Vorhaben, so Cabaret-Sängerin zu werden, abzuhalten. Der studiert dann mit ihr Shakespeare-Gedichte und Shakespeare-Rollen ein. Und es ist alles völlig absurd. Dieser Schauspiellehrer heißt John Wilkes Booth, der natürlich später der Lincoln-Attentäter ist. Das heißt, diese ganze Geschichte wird da so umgedeutet. Und Cole Escola hat sich diese Rolle Mary, das ganze Ding heißt ja auch Oh Mary, auf den Leib geschrieben. Und es hat so was ganz Größenwahnsinniges. Es endet dann natürlich mit einem Cabaret-Act. Sie verwirklicht sich dann tatsächlich Mary. Und das ist so charmant und so lustig. Das war tatsächlich, glaube ich, so das Schönste, was ich bis jetzt gesehen habe. Und hat so diesen Größenwahn von einer Person, die sich hinstellt und sagt, ich schreibe hier ein Stück, das spielen insgesamt 5 Leute mit, ich bin der Central Character und mit meinen ganzen Flaws und mit, ich glaube so, Cole Escola liebt eben auch alte Schauspielerinnen und dieses Kabarett-Genre von Diven, die dann da stehen und noch mit 70 mit heiserer Stimme ihre Hits präsentieren und vergöttert werden. So, das liebt er sehr. Und so diese Liebe hat er so umgesetzt in diesem Stück. Und das ist natürlich auch so eine Traditionslinie im amerikanischen Theater. Einfach so Persönlichkeiten, die Chuzpe haben, so ein ganzes Ding um sich herum zu schreiben. Und eine der ganz großen Figuren, die da vielleicht auch prägend waren und ohne die so Werke wie die von Cole Escola oder auch die Projekte von Taylor Mack vielleicht gar nicht möglich wären, ist Charles Bush, der als Drag-Performer angefangen hat, sich dann eine Truppe aufgebaut hat in den 70er, 80er Jahren und am Ende dann damit auch bis zum Broadway gelangt ist, auch Stücke für den Broadway geschrieben hat. Ihn durfte ich hier in New York treffen und interviewen. Ist auch so ein Meister des Titels. Seine Stücke haben Titel wie Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. In unserem Gespräch erzählt er auch von der Entstehung dieses Stückes, das so ein bisschen sein Durchbruch war, 1985. Pardon My Inquisition or Kiss the Blood of My Castanets. Gidget Goes Psychotic. Psycho Beach Party, The Lady in Questions. Red Scare on Sunset. Flipping My Wig. Queen Amarantha, Die, Mummy, Die, The Tell of the Allergist's Wife, das war dann sein Stück am Broadway, darüber sprechen wir in der nächsten Episode. Ich glaube, in diesem Gespräch hört man schon ganz viel von dem, was am amerikanischen Theater vielleicht dann auch toll ist. Also so ein bisschen Größenwahn, die Liebe zum Theater an sich. Ich fand es ein total inspirierendes Gespräch und ja, ich wünsche euch viel Spaß bei dem Gespräch mit Charles Bush.
I think it's very rare to find a place in New York in any stratum that you don't have to go through all sorts of channels and to get your, as a playwright, to get your play done. And I've been fortunate that I kind of created my own way. And it might have been a lack of broader vision. You know, I didn't really have a great dream of, my goal as a young person, my goal is to be on Broadway, or my goal to have a TV series. I really wasn't thinking that. I went to Northwestern University, which is a prestigious university, and I majored in theater, but I don't know. I was just too androgynous and gay. And there was in 1972 when I first went to school, there really was no dramatic literature for, you know, the androgynous young person. There just wasn't. And this was before I played Torch Song Trilogy, which was, you know, big revolutionary moment in theater, and or Angels of America a bit later. There were no roles that I was right for. Yeah, and I was blessed, I think, with a rather pragmatic nature of things and not living in a fantasy world of who I would like to be or think I am. Or I believe I just had a sense of who I was and what I had to offer, which was this rather androgynous nature and a great fascination for actresses of of the theater of the past and classic film. But really, in a way, my big interest was theater history. Okay. And studying actresses who were basically never on film.
Yeah.
You know, from Sarah Bernhardt to Anduza to the great actresses of the early 20th century in America, Catherine Cornell, Laurette Taylor, Lynn Fontanne, even though I could never really see them, but just reading about their lives and careers and the dramatic literature that they inspired. Because I always wrote, but I never really thought in terms of being a playwright. It was more to give myself opportunities to act, that if I was this rather unique person, I would have to create my own roles because there's nothing else that's there. Yeah. Nothing for me. And I wasn't afraid of starting, you know, at the bottom. You know, I put on a play with some of my friends, the play that I wrote and wrote the leading role for myself. And we did it at school. Because the other thing that was a challenge was that Northwestern, even though it was a noted fine theater program, when I was there, there was no playwriting program at all. You took maybe one semester, a class, and there was nothing in place to put on an original play. So, you know, I put on this little play with my friends and it felt, you know, I played the female character and I got a wonderful response from people.
How old were you there?
So I must have been 20.
Okay.
Yeah, senior year.
Yeah.
And it was so encouraging. I thought, yeah, this is who I am. I knew right away. I thought, this is who I am, that if I'm going to have a creative life and some sort of career, it will be by writing roles for myself that are unique to who I am. And
what was the play called?
It was called Sister Act. But this was many years before the famous movie. It was a one act, and I wrote it very quickly. I mean, it wasn't terribly ambitious, but it was about a circus freak show and the people working in it. And so the central characters were a pair of Siamese twin sort of showgirls, and they had this act. And my character, the one sister, she's wants them to get separated. She really wants her independence, and the other sister's gay, actually, is lesbian. That's my friend Ed's part, and he was very happy with their otherness, whether it's as twins or being gay. But you know, my characters wanted you know, independence, and I guess it made a big impression on the people who came to see it too. Later, I've heard that people said, "Oh, that I'd never seen anything like that, and somebody playing a female character and all that." But all I know is for me, it made me feel, okay, this is the path.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very influenced by a remarkable playwright, actor, director, Charles Ludlam, who had his own theater company down here in Greenwich Village called the Ridiculous Theatrical Company. And he was a real major figure. And when I first saw him, when I was maybe 17, I was just so dazzled. I've been brought up in New York going to the theater, but, you know, just seeing the commercial musicals and plays on Broadway.
So you were brought up in a household where.
Yeah, I was really raised by my aunt. My mother died when I was 7 years old. And ultimately I was adopted when I was 14. By my Aunt Lillian, who was a widow and had no children, lived here in Manhattan. And I've been involved with her my whole life, really. She was my mother's older sister. And she really was the major figure in my life, most influential figure in my life. And started taking me to theater, you know, 8 years old. And this was completely encouraging, fascinated by me. I found her fascinating too. Yeah, I don't know what would have become of me if she hadn't stepped in. So anyway, I first saw Ludlam, though, you know, it was such so radically different from what I had seen before, and the fact that we seemed to have the same frame of reference of classic film and theater history and love of actresses and men playing female characters.
Mm-hmm.
but just, you know, it wasn't like a, you know, a drag show. It was, they were playing characters in just a flamboyant style. Oh, it was just extraordinary to see the possibilities that were open to me.
Mm-hmm.
The theater could be whatever I dream it to be. Didn't have to fit into certain categories. So I kind of modeled myself a little bit on him. Yeah.
What were the venues you then started producing?
Well, so then I graduated, and my university was in Illinois, outside mm-hmm. Chicago. So I wasn't ready to just come back home to New York City. I had had this great experience doing Sister Act for, you know, one night, but it was enough to think, make me think, yes, this is who I am. So I stayed in Chicago for two more years, experimenting, writing short plays and putting them on in gay bars and anywhere I could get on stage.
Yeah.
So I started a little theater company with some people I met, and they were the wrong people because we didn't share enough of a point of view, which was meaning that I was to be the star. They didn't quite share that point of view, that I was the star, you know. And so then after about 2 years, though, but it was enough for me to gain confidence, I came back home to New York, and it was just kind of hard to, like, how do you start?
Yeah.
I mean, it's I think, a little clearer if you wanted a traditional career. Just,
yeah.
Find out where there are auditions. How do you become, you know, playwright, star, drag legend?
Yeah.
Where do you begin? And so since I knew no one and had no contacts, I thought, well, I'd written a play for another play for that little theater company in Chicago. And when I broke up with them, I thought, well, they're good lines. Maybe I could just turn it into a solo piece mm-hmm. and I could play all the parts myself.
In New York.
Yeah. It was called Hollywood Confidential. And so I turned it into a solo piece where I played all the parts. And, you know, and at that point, I was sort of the only thing I kept changing costume pieces. Like if I was the reporter, I'd have a fedora on and a trench coat. Then I'd take that off and I'd put on a blonde wig and I was the actress, or, you know, I'd put on a big hat, be the gossip columnist. So I, you know, but where do you do it?
Yeah.
I know no one. So I was wandering around this neighborhood and there was a little tiny cabaret called Scene One. And, you know, I just walked in there one afternoon and out of the sun and saw the manager was there. And so this place, Scene One, they'd hire anybody. You know, if you had a sign in your back saying, you know, escapee from mental institution, they'd still get. So what do you want, Tuesday nights at 7? So he booked me for a couple nights. And so, you know, you just invite your friends, you know, I had maybe 6 people. So, and then there was another club called the Duplex that was very legendary cabaret in the 50s and 60s. And then it closed for many years. And I just was wandering by again in the afternoon, and I said, the door's open. What's going on? You know, and I went inside and I met this guy, Irv, who was the owner. And he said that he and his lover had been teachers at a arts high school in Ohio. And they'd shocked all their friends. They left their teaching positions, moved to New York, and bought this long closed cabaret.
I know that name. Duplex.
Yeah, well, because
it was a gay club or a gay. No.
Well, you know, every cabaret is sort of gayish. You know,
yeah.
Duplex was very famous in the 50s and 60s. Joan Rivers and, you know, all these famous comedians started out there. But Irv and his lover Rob, they took it over, and again, I just, you know, I walked in and I said, well, could I just perform a little bit of my show for you? So, okay, sat there. And so I was, you know, playing all the characters. You know, and anyway, he just, well, because, you know, he was acting teacher or something at that high school. So he was very loved that I was part of theater, you know, and he had this kind of vision for the Duplex to go beyond just singers and comedians, that he had a bigger vision. So he booked me there and had great faith in me because, you know, nobody, I was so unknown that yeah. I'd be lucky if I got six friends to come, you know, to pay the cover charge. But he developed a kind of little group of performers who all were rather offbeat, you know, and that took the idea of cabaret just a little beyond the usual. Mm-hmm. And he made me part of that family. And that was marvelous. And
are there other people you remember from this group?
Yeah, there's this woman, Julie Kernitz, who's a very tall, rather strange singing comedian. And then Ruby Rims, who's still sort of around as a kind of more traditional kind of drag queen.
Okay. You know, Ruby Rims,
mm-hmm. yeah. And this guy Bruce Hopkins. And they were all just sort of offbeat, you know, and I fit the bill. And it was just nice being supported, you know, to have this encouragement. Not that it necessarily took me anywhere, but it was nice. And it gave me a venue to grow with these monologues. And where the next person who really influenced me was a downtown performance artist named Jeff Weiss. And he was fascinating because he did solo plays and there was no costumes or anything. And he was wildly physical and they were very grotesque and scary. And he had a play where he was twin brothers who, you know, were trying to kill each other. And he was like, it was very athletic and he was just like all over the space. But he would do the dialogue since he didn't change costumes. He would do the two men talking back and forth so fast that you really did feel that you were seeing this horrible, violent fight between yeah. these two men.
Okay.
And so that was so interesting to me. And so I thought, okay, I don't need to, you know, change hats and wigs and all that. That's better. And that the kind of storytelling that I was trying to do was best to just simplify. So that was the next thing that helped shape me. And, but, you know, in a way I still, you know, what I loved about theater was, you know, flamboyance and color and yet the kind of solo material I was doing was very minimalist because that suited that. And then, I did that for nearly a decade throughout my 30s. I never got a grant or anything or funding. One time I had a contact with the Merrill Ingram Foundation that gave grants for poets. And I was far from a poet, but I kind of knew somebody involved. So I applied, but I didn't get it.
Yeah. Those early shows, were they all solo shows?
Yes. Also, I was just a solo performer how many years really? 78. Actually, it wasn't 10 years now. 78 to 84. In New York, of course, nobody. It was just so hard to ever get more than, you know, 10 people see me.
Yeah.
But I got an opportunity to do my show, a full two-act version in Washington, D.C. at a small nonprofit theater there, the Source Theater. And I did that. And somehow I got just, it was tiny. They gave me a tiny space, like 30 people sitting in this little theater space. But somehow, I guess I'd grown, I'd learned, and I got rave reviews from the Washington Post.
Oh, my God.
From the gay papers to the, you know, the alternative press. I mean, every paper, just rave review. I thought, what, you know, because the only time I'd been reviewed, but one time I got an opportunity to do my solo show back in Chicago. I went back to Chicago and a very, very, very nice theater produced me, but oh, it was disaster. And I got the most homophobic, awful reviews, just, you know, the unapologetically swishy, you know, Charles Bush displays no talent whatsoever as writer or performer. You know, I was just terrible. I was just, when I came back home, my aunt just was like, oh, she used to say, I was so worried. You were just, face was just green. You were so demoralized. But then, you know, a couple years later, I guess I had grown and learned a lot. So in Washington, D.C., they said I was a cross between Laurence Olivier, Glenda Jackson, and what happened? You know, and and so that gave me confidence to try to book my solo show in other cities.
Okay.
And
start touring.
A big dream of mine was to see, in a way, again, I didn't have a big overriding ambition of, I mean, I was very ambitious and so driven, yeah. You know, nothing would stop me, but I wasn't thinking like of a big thing, like, I got to get on Broadway. You know, I've got to be a movie star. It was always like the next thing. Like, okay. I got to get my act in San Francisco. I got to do my act in San Francisco. How do I do that? And so I did that, and I became a big hit in San Francisco and at that club. And I returned for several years each year with a new repertoire. And, you know, so I started just playing. I could not earn a living, mind you, doing all this.
How did you earn your living?
Well, I draw very well.
Okay.
And so I became a quick sketch portrait artist. You know what that is?
Yes.
I would work at, in the summer, there'd be art fairs, and I'd have my easel up and draw people. Or there was, I don't know, do you know what a Renaissance fair is?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if they probably have them in Europe, but
yeah,
there was the New York Renaissance Fair, and I had had a little booth there somewhere. And I can make a lot of money, and you know, and you didn't pay taxes on it.
Okay.
All cash.
Yeah.
So that I could make enough money from the 6 weekends at the fair to kind of tide me over for, you know, 6 months or so.
Yeah, that's also what I'm always wondering. New York is also like the city is so expensive, also art wise, like to produce something.
Yeah.
It's so hard.
Well, I couldn't really, that's why I was usually just playing in cabarets where they would, you know, there was no budget, you know,
and
they, you know, you'd get, you know, a percentage of what comes in
Do you think like this, even when your productions and your plays and bigger, this like having no money mentality, like making something out of nothing,
it's actually fun. I thought it was fun. You know, I never thought of it as demoralizing. The next big thing was that, I mean, I'm sort of telling the story of my life.
Of course.
But just, in 1984, so I've been, you know, doing this act and encouraged enough, but still I'm basically unknown except for in these little pockets of, you know, gay communities. My roommate, I used to live just around the corner on the next block over 12th Street. It's a beautiful street, but it's funny, it's still there. There's one horrible tenement building on this very beautiful street, and that's where I lived. And it's still, I still don't quite understand. If you walk up 12th Street, it's just the next block.
Okay.
You'll see every building is so beautiful, except for this one horrible building. You wonder why that has not been gentrified. I don't know. Anyway, it's still there. So anyway, my roommate, Ken, had been directing my act. You know, and I had met a woman performer at the Renaissance Fair who was this very exotic woman from Pakistan named Bina Sharif, she called herself. And
just star name.
Yes. Well, that wasn't her real name. But anyway, she was a performance artist. She was hired at the Renaissance Fair to play like a gypsy. And she was just roaming around, you know, and harassing people. But anyway, we stayed friends after the summer. And she said she was doing a performance piece way down, way far in East Village, beyond East Village to Alphabet City, it's called. Mm-hmm. Because when you go all the way east, the avenues are just called Avenue A, Avenue B, Avenue C.
Okay.
And in 1984, it was very scary neighborhood. And a lot of drugs and very low rents, you know, because it was so undeveloped that there were little pockets of art galleries and dance clubs. Madonna came out of that area, and Keith Haring, the painter. I had never actually been that far to the east side, but Ken and I walked over there to see Bina do her act, and I was so just fascinated by this venue. It was called the Limbo Lounge. It was a little narrow storefront, and it was an art gallery, but they also used it as a performance space. There was no stage or anything. It was just kind of the far end of the room, and it was kind of a rock club. At the time, they did rock bands. It was so exotic. I felt like I was in Berlin in 1930. It was so like that. And Vina's act, she was, you know, with all this glitter in her hair, and she was just reciting the names of designer perfumes. It was a very exotic way. And, oh, I was just taken with the whole thing.
Yeah.
Immediately. And
yeah.
It was so decadent. And all the crowd was sort of gay, sort of punk, sort of goth, you know. And as soon as it was over, I mean, as soon as Bina finished the last word, I said, Ken, we've got to do a show here somehow. And before he could say yes or no, I was running around trying to find who's the owner? Who's the owner? And it was this young guy who called himself Michael Limbo, have his head was shaved, and he was a very exotic young gay guy. And I just said, I would just love to perform here. And, you know, I was unknown, and, you know, but it was so loose. He just got out this big calendar, you know, and said, well, you can do Friday and Saturday nights 6 weeks from now. I thought, I'll take it. And I said, Ken, we're doing a play. And he said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I don't want to do my, you know, solo shows all dressed in black and just me, you know, being serious. You know, we've got to do something that's very decadent and fitting this room. And, you know, I really wanted to, you know, I missed working with other people. And so I was working as I was doing like office temp work, mm-hmm. you know, and so we needed 45 minutes of dialogue. Something to do. So just, you know, as a receptionist, so I was just sitting there like, okay, what could we do for no money at all? No budget. I said, but I want to play female character. I want to be this, you know, Sarah Bernhardt. And I had read Interview with the Vampire, those first couple books. And I thought that was very romantic. So I thought, well, I could be this ageless vampire. So with some, I need a rival and another vampire. And we're just over centuries battling it, feuding. And so I just, you know, wrote this piece really, really fast. I mean, like a couple hours. I just needed dialogue and needed a title. And my best friend from college, who is now had a big job as an advertising executive, I described the story to him. And he just said, why don't you call it? He was trying to think of like an exploitation sort of novel title, Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. I said, that's fine. That'll do. It didn't matter. You know, it was for two nights. And then I needed to cast it and just thought of, okay, the different people I'd gathered through my life. I thought, well, Ken will direct it and he can also be in it. Oh, my friend Kathy, who still is my closest friend, she had stage managed my solo show. One time we got a chance to do it in New York, which was a flop, but she was very pragmatic and, you know, stage manager type. So
the chair needs to be here.
So she's good to have. And then my friend Andy, who I'd known from summer camp, you know, we'd been friends all our lives. And well, he's very sensible and be good for this. So he's just an actress I'd met in Washington, D.C. And then for my rival, I thought, oh, Bina should do it. You know, she's the star, you know, they know her.
Yeah.
So even though it was very hard understanding anything she said with her Pakistani accent, she couldn't pronounce the letter V. It was like Wampir, but whatever. So we rehearsed in we read through it in my living room, and the next day she called up, said that her mother in Pakistan had a stroke and she had to fly immediately and couldn't do the play. So I called up. I knew this marvelous actress who worked with Charles Ludlam, who was 15 years older than me, and called herself Lola Pashalinsky. She'd won an Obie Award and all this.
What a name.
And she had always been nice to me, encouraging, like some of the other people, but She was nice to me. So I called her and she said, okay. And anyway, so we just rehearsed it a couple times in my living room, and really it's like $35. The costumes, we just kind of, pieced together from stuff I had, and we just kind of threw it together, and we just had a great time, and it was just really fun, and I want to do it again. And Lola wouldn't do it a second time. She was so far beyond that. She liked actually, getting paid. She liked having a bathroom, stuff like that, like weird shit like that. Yeah. So I needed another vampire, and everybody turned me down. My own sister turned me down. Last one on my list was this blonde girl who, she worked on Wall Street as like a, corporate librarian, but I'd met her once before, and she had sort of fantasies about being a performance artist, and I saw her try to do it, and it was terrible, but I was just desperate. And, so I called her up. I was sort of hoping she'd say no. And she said, oh yeah, sure. I said, yeah, okay. And so I said, well, would you just come over and meet my roommate? And it's not an audition. Well, she came over and we read through the script, and she was so bad. And Ken said, Charles, can I just talk to you in the kitchen for a second? And so the kitchen was there. Julie said she overheard the entire conversation. She's terrible. She can't act. She was, it's all we've got, So anyway, so she did it. And her name's Julie Halston. Oh, you've seen her like on Just Like That and stuff like that?
No, I know her from like all the Broadway stuff I look up at YouTube.
Yeah. Well, she's a
legend.
Yeah. But she like had never really acted before, and she was terrible, but she's such a wonderful personality.
Yeah.
And she was always that way. And so when we rehearsed it in my living room with the cast, and who were basically all amateurs, and even they were horrified at how bad she was. And finally she just stopped the rehearsal. She said, okay, listen, I know I stink, but I'm telling you, you put me in a wig in front of 60 gay men and I glow. And it was sort of true.
It's the truth,
probably. It was the truth. She got, first of all, the whole audience were her friends, because she knew all these people, and they all were rooting for her. And somehow, it wasn't like she was good, but she was a big personality, and we all adored her, and it was just we all just loved her.
And you collaborated for.
Yeah, so I've written like 13 roles for her over the years. Yeah. And so she was part of the group. And what I love to this day, I love writing roles for specific people, and what was really interesting, and it was just by chance that each of the people of our little company, suddenly we had a company, who knew, but they all were such unique, eccentric people that it was kind of easy to try to develop them, and Julie, she had not been encouraged, when she had, tried to be an actress, people, or even at school, they told her,
tone it down.
And, she speaks with a real New York accent, and it was, you can't talk that way. You have to try to speak, in a more normal, beautiful speech. And so she just wiped out all her personality. And the one time I had seen her try to be a performance artist, she was just trying to talk in this very, nice lady voice. But when she would tell me stories about her mother, and she'd tell these stories, and it was so funny. Or even in just the way she would talk in real life, like, in conversation, if she was here right now, it's like she has her own talk show. Like, so, Charles, thoughts and reflections about the death of Marvin Gaye. I mean, talks like this, it was so funny. So I started writing it in. So I rewrote Vampire Lesbians to put her what I call her trip, into it. So she can't, it's hard for her to play grand, but she can play somebody who's a real kind of tough dame who's trying to put on airs. So I would, you know, I would write lines in for her, like, "True, I have caskets full of precious jewels, but where the fuck can I wear them?" You know, it's do the flip.
Yeah.
And that's where I realized, yeah, oh, that's who she is, you know. So we can develop this persona for her. And
who else was part of this ensemble?
Well, just, you know, my friend Andy Halliday and Teresa Seves, who I renamed Teresa Marlowe, and our ingenue, and this very funny fellow, Tom Alino, who went to college with us, was very, really funny himself. And then this young, very handsome young man who worked as a children's magician, children's parties, birthday parties. I met him at the Renaissance Fair, and he became the leading man. And then it was just typical of us. Ken had been dating this gorgeous boy, Bobby, who so this beautiful body and these big, like, Brigitte Bardot lips. But he spoke with a very kind of almost Harvey Fierstein sort of voice. And he had never had any interest in being an actor at all. But anyway, when we first were going to do the show, the first time at the Limbo Lounge, Ken said, "Well, couldn't you just write Bobby in? Just, you know, it'd be nice. Just, he's never acted for." Well, you know, he was so cute, and he had this great, beautiful, smooth body, gym body. And so the first scene took place in ancient Sodom. So, well, you know, so there has to be a guard, right? Yeah. You know, so he and Arnie both were like the two guards. And it was kind of, I've never seen anyone with lesser aptitude for the stage. You know, but it was actually kind of funny, and that, you know, this gorgeous boy, then he opens his mouth and it's like, you know, "Hark, I hear them coming," you know. And, you know, and he was just so sweet. We just adored him so. And, you know, I can't even talk about it.
So, just, so he's not longer with us.
Yeah. He died in the first kind of wave of AIDS. Anyway, he was just so darling, and so, you know, and sometimes, you know, in an ensemble, there are other qualities that are as important as talent.
Yeah, of course.
You know? And he was essential because he was the cheerleader.
How many projects did he?
He was in all our early plays, and then, you know. So the miracle was, so we do this Vampire Lesbians, and somehow it takes off, you know, in this bar, you know. I don't know, just word got out.
Even I know it in Germany.
Word got out, and people were lined up down the block. Just, I thought, this is, it's not very good, you know, but they, I don't know. It was the right moment to, you know, AIDS was just start really hitting. And I think the gay community, particularly, suddenly there's a new drag queen who's pretty and, you know, and young and with her friends and putting on something with this crazy title. And I find it a little bit similar to what's going on with O'Mary here in New York, that, you know, people, we're living in such scary times that suddenly here's this very pretty young drag queen who writes her own plays. And it's just pure silliness. There's no underlying politics or anything. It's just fun and a great escape. So I really think that it's on a bigger level because it's on Broadway, but it's very similar situation.
Yeah, because you somehow also paved the way for those.
Cole Scully is part of, there's Ludlam, me, and then Cole, you know, and he's a very nice fellow. But anyway, it started taking off. And we started doing other plays down there just for like 3 week runs. I just really wanted to be Sarah Bernhardt. So I wrote a 45 minute version of a play she might have done called Theodora, She Bitch of Byzantium, where I played the Empress Theodora. You know, and each, we had to justify Bobby's, you know,
nakedness.
So every scene, every play, he does, it's close to be ripped off, or, you know, there's, somehow you have to, there's a reason why the guy who can't act at all, who's so gorgeous, is in this play.
Yeah.
And
probably also became like a running gag.
We had always running
things. Yes. Like, what is the reason now?
Yeah, you're going to say, oh, at one point we're going to see his ass.
Yeah.
Because the ass is so fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, so there's going to be some point there. Or Teresa, our ingenue, had this incredible scream, so we had to work in someplace. And then, or Julie talking like, you know, this kind of, you know, New York lady. Yes, everybody had what I called their trip.
Where did you perform?
So these are, originally it was all at the Limbo Lounge.
Yeah.
After like a couple months there, they closed for the summer because they moved to a larger space in the same neighborhood, but it had been like a auto garage, and they sort of turned it into a larger club.
Yeah.
And then we returned in the fall. We did three plays there in repertory, we called it. And we became Theater in Limbo. We took that name because we were at the Limbo Lounge. Really kind of crazy though, with really no publicity, just that we got such a following that I was kind of shocked, but it was so exciting. It was so thrilling. And then Ken thought, well, maybe could this be commercial? And he invited different producers to see it, and nobody wanted to touch it. And then Ken thought, well, maybe we could just produce it ourselves. Could we raise the money? It seemed like a lot of money. It was not very much money, but it seemed a lot to us, $55,000. And so we just were determined, and everybody's family and friends pitched in, and, you know, $5,000 here, $5,000 there. And we actually raised the money fairly quickly over the course of maybe 6 months, mm-hmm. let's say. And so then we were able to acquire the Provincetown Playhouse. Was a legendary little theater in the West Village that had been founded by Eugene O'Neill and Edna St. Vincent Millay in the 20s. Mm-hmm. But by 1978, it really had fallen on hard times, and nothing played there very long. But we were able to get a very low rent for it. And we had raised just enough money to open, to get us through opening night. But, you know, really you're supposed to raise money for a few months in case it takes off. But we did the best we could. And and then there was a big decision to make. Do we bring Bobby with us? Because, this is now going to be, we're going to be reviewed in all the newspapers. And Ken said, oh, we have to. We would kill him. One person I'm taking.
Yeah.
And so but this time around, we actually had a budget. We raised some money. We had costumes and wigs and sets and the whole thing. And we opened, and it was critics come during previews, mm-hmm. and Times critic came and, what's going to be. And then we had our opening night, and it was mostly, friends and investors and whatever. When the play was over, everybody was kind of gathered in the green room, and an early edition of the New York Times came out, and somebody brought it in, and we were all so terrified. It had been such a fantasy, the whole experience, and just pure out of just love and affection and enthusiasm. And the review was read out loud, and it was just this rave review that everybody got mentioned.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Everybody got mentioned. Kathy's wigs, everything, and I knew that my life has changed forever. And it doesn't always happen that way. A lot of times off Broadway.
That would be considered an off Broadway.
It was off Broadway play. Yeah. Because the theater only sat like 150 or something.
Yeah.
It was off Broadway and commercial off Broadway.
Yeah.
But, a lot of times plays open off Broadway and don't really change people's lives. But from that moment on, I could earn my living as an actor writer. And the next day, these big agencies were wooing me. William Morris Agency and ICM wanted me to be their client. I mean, what? Just, it was crazy, but it was just I consider it a miracle.
Yeah.
It was just a miracle.